Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Well.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, get ready for the doldrums of summer. August and September always tend to be slower months at the box office, but this year they're absolutely dead. According to Lucas Shaw at Bloomberg, there are exactly zero movies tracking to debut at more than $40 million at the box office over the next two-plus months. Indeed, I was just looking at the schedule. After Bullet Train debuts in the first weekend of August, which is the upcoming Brad Pitt movie from the director of Deadpool and Deadpool 2, I think, or maybe just Deadpool 2, I can't remember. Anyway, after that, there are basically no movies, period, getting releases. I mean, there are movies, but like big movies that people want to see? I don't know, guys. Maybe the Idris Elba movie Beast, elevator pitch, Jaws, but with lions, pops off. Maybe the horror-starved teens and young adults show up for Invitation at the end of August. Maybe Sly Stallone can get the olds to show up for Samaritan. Wait. Hold on, let me, breaking news, this just in, Samaritan, going to debut on Prime Video now. Prey, the Predator prequel, gonna debut on Hulu in a couple weeks here. Netflix will have some filler, I'm sure, but, you know, theaters, kinda empty. It's like genuinely a little bit crazy how little there is. Again, some cheapo horror, movies like Barbarian or Smile. There's the gay rom-com, Bros, that's coming up. I haven't even seen trailers for anything that's coming out until, like, October 14th, when the new Halloween movie drops. Black Adam, the new joint from The Rock, drops a weekend after that, and then things kind of get back to normal, or at least a little more regularly. But that is 2.5 very lean months coming up. Number one, this is a huge problem for us, for you and me, the listeners, and Alyssa and Peter and me. And we are in bad shape here because we have to find something to talk about each and every week. And it's very hard. It's very hard when there's not like a big movie dominating the weekend landscape. It's a problem for theaters, of course, which need a stream of movies to keep people coming in and buying popcorn, right? And it's a problem for the studios, which have all suffered a fairly significant disruption in their content pipeline. The number of films opening on 2,000 plus screens, down 30%. That helps explain why the overall box office is down 40% from its peak in 2019, and also why the overall box office is so top heavy. The top 10 movies of the year so far account for nearly 65% of the year's grosses overall. In 2019, the same number, 10 movies, accounted for the top 40%. Peter, most important question here first, what the hell are we going to talk about these next couple months?
Well, there's Better Call Saul. I think we're going to do an episode on that. There's She-Hulk. We could do
House of the Dragon.
We could do.
There's a new Game of Thrones show.
Yeah, there's a new Game of Thrones show. So this is actually one of the things that I think is interesting about this moment is that as studio features being released theatrically are drying up for a period of time, not for the whole year, but for a period of time, there is, in fact, going to be a steady stream of fairly high profile content, TV sort of episodic content coming to the streamers. And so there's She-Hulk. There's a new Star Wars show, Andor, right? Something like that, that's coming out in the next couple
Andor.
Of months. There's
a prequel.
There's the Game of Thrones prequel coming out on HBO. Prey, which you mentioned, isn't Prey a series? I'm pretty sure Prey is a series.
No,
it's not.
Prey's just a movie.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
I'm pretty sure it's just a movie. I might be wrong, but I'll check. I'll effort that.
That's us, the experts here. We know all of this stuff, right? But this is, I think, indicative of the way that, you know, sort of the entertainment world is going, which is that there are going to be more lulls in the feature release schedule because even though the box office is back to some extent, right, we've seen big hits and we've seen people willing to come back, it's down something like 40% from the same time in 2019, right? It, like the overall numbers, right, the overall spend on 2022 box office is considerably down from like the pre-pandemic baseline. And all of the studios, all of the production companies have rolled out these big, these big budget, high draw, streamers that are supposed to be, if not the main revenue sources for the next decade or two, some of the main revenue sources for these companies for the next couple of decades. And so they're putting a lot of big, high profile content on those things instead. And so even if there's nothing along the lines of Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which came out last year at the beginning of September. Even if there's not a Black Adam, you know, which was supposed to drop a new Mission Impossible, which was, I believe, supposed to be coming out during this window. Right. And that's part of the reason that this window is so empty, is because there were, in fact, two very big releases. There was a big superhero movie starring The Rock in the DC universe, and there was a big Tom Cruise action franchise that would have probably done huge business based on what we've seen out of Top Gun 2, right? Like, I feel like the sort of the tailwinds of Maverick would have carried that film. And I almost want, I understand, like, my sense is that they delayed it because of production issues, not just because of the box office environment. But I almost wonder if they are losing money by pushing it back to next year, just given how Maverick performed. But anyway, I just think that, like, this, the world we are going to live in is not going to be one in which it's like, well, there's nothing to watch for 2 months, but we are going to increasingly see periods of time in which maybe there's nothing to watch at a theater for a couple of months, especially if you are focused on AAA productions, you know, big budget, $100 million kind of high profile type things. There is, you know, there's a new George Miller movie coming out. There's 3,000 Years of Longing, and I'm really excited about that, even if no one
I'm
else.
I'm sure it's going to be a big hit. I'm sure that's going to be a big hit. I mean, look, here's I take your point, but, you know, this is not how movie theaters work as a business. I mean, it's just it's a real problem for them just in terms of, you know, making rents and stuff. It's an issue. Alyssa, there's also a labor issue here, because one of the interesting subtexts in that, or really just texts in that Bloomberg piece, was that the special effects houses are hugely overworked. They're all dealing with these massive crunches, and that's one of the reasons films aren't ready yet, is because the FX houses just do not have their stuff together post-pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, and look, I think that there are a bunch of places where things have gotten bunched up. I mean, you know, everything is more, you know, that piece also mentioned that everything is more expensive because you have these COVID production protocols too. And so, you know, they're like, all of this stuff may filter down in a way that makes it harder for some movies to get made, period, right? I mean, if you're, you know, a small movie trying to figure out if you can pay for your COVID protocols and trying to break into a VFX schedule, you know, there's just a lot of stuff here that is bunched up and is going to take some time to get sorted out, period. But I'm not sure I am as pessimistic as Peter about sort of the cadence of the schedule. I think part of what we're experiencing now is, you know, the ripple effects from production shutdowns 2 years ago, right? I mean, you know, the way the movie business works is that, you know, stuff gets shot in person and then edited and, you know, tested and ultimately released. So I think we're still sort of working through that weird dip in production. I also think that as, you know, as the streaming business sorts itself out, you know, Apple is planning on sending some more of its movies to theatrical runs. I think that, you know, Coda winning the Oscar for them probably, you know, intensifies their commitment to the movie business. So we'll get some more Apple movies in theaters. You know, Netflix is very screwed up about what it's going to do, but, you know, they, like everyone else, are recognizing that it's good to have multiple revenue streams if you want to be in the content business. And so, you know, they've sort of screwed around a little bit with that, but they may ultimately decide that it makes a certain amount of sense to get some of these movies in theaters. So I agree that we're in a state of flux, but I don't think we're anywhere close to a place where the new normal has arrived.
I agree that the new normal hasn't arrived, but I do think that this is a sign of something changing. And it's interesting that, you know, we were talking about there's nothing coming out for a couple of months. Well, there are, in fact, movies being released in theaters every single Friday for the next couple of months. And so now many of them are being released, not on a lot of screens, right? Like, but they're not big movies. And this is what we're talking about, is they're not movies that are tracking big in advance, which means they are not pre-engineered mega hits. And that's what we're talking about not having for a couple of months. Like, that used to be kind of normal. Like, you would have pre-engineered mega hits in the summer and then around the Christmas season. And then the rest of the year was filled out with stuff that was maybe not riskier or sort of necessarily edgier, but was not intended or not sort of designed in a lab like Marvel movies are, or like Black Adam, or even something like Dune, to make, you know, $500 million at the box office. And so it is like the issue here is that theaters have increasingly become reliant on those pre-engineered mega hits. And the business model is now all about having something like 40 of those a year, right? One, not quite every week, but close to every week, so that theaters can, you know, can keep butts in seats. And that, like, that's a change. I mean, yes, we were moving in that direction pre-pandemic. Absolutely, right? There were, but it's not like this is something that only happened because of COVID. At the same time, COVID accelerated it. And it's, you know, I mean, there's a Sigourney Weaver movie coming out at the end of September, right? There's stuff coming to theaters. It's just not stuff that people are looking at. There's this Letitia Wright coming out movie coming out in the middle of September, right? It's just that there's not these films that we are all sort of like set to talk about, have built-in fandoms, our sequels, our zillion-dollar productions, our, you know, or like something like the like Nope, which is a $70 million movie, but is, you know, a somewhere between a prestige picture and a blockbuster.
And maybe that's not such a terrible thing, right? I mean, you know, we've all talked about experiences with movies we had that sort of, became hits over time. You know, for me, that was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, having this, you know, massive run at my tiny third run independent theater in the town where I was growing up. I mean, I think all of us were pretty excited earlier in the year when Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, sort of took off via word of mouth and became, you know, not a massive hit, but something that was like quite successful for what it was and that had people excited and talking about it, that's getting a theatrical re-release. And, you know, I don't know if any of the movies on the schedule are going to operate like that. I'm really excited to see The Woman King. I'm really interested to see Don't Worry, Darling. I love Florence Pugh. And, you know, the idea of a sort of Stepford Wives adjacent thing starring her and Harry Styles is interesting to me. I don't know if any of these movies will break out, but at least now they have more of a chance than they might otherwise, and maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Two things here. One, you mentioned the filming costs, Alyssa, and I do think it's worth thinking about just how much the COVID protocols and everything else have radically expanded the cost. I mean, like, a movie like Nope should not have cost $70 million to make. I mean, there are some FX in it, sure. They're shooting on film. They're shooting on, you know, in L.A., whatever. That's going to increase the cost. But that's a lot of money for a movie that, like, very frequently doesn't have a ton of extras. There's not, you know, big sweeping action battle scenes, whatever. I mean, a lot of money. But also, like, a movie like The Black Phone. I mean, that movie cost $18 million to make, something like that. Not a ton of money. But considering, again, what sort of movie that is, you know, 5 years ago, that's a $5 to $10 million movie, probably. And not a $15 to $20 million.
There was a report that The Northman was initially budgeted at, I believe, $65 or $70 million and came in at $90 or a little over, almost entirely due to COVID protocols.
Yeah. You have to hire more people for the sets. You have to have people testing all the time. You shut down for days when somebody gets sick. I mean, it's a real hassle. It's a real problem.
And this isn't stuff that is, in most cases, state required at this point. This is because the movie business genuinely is different in that, maybe if a grip is out sick, you can continue production. But if your stars get sick and have to quarantine for 10 days, if your director gets sick and can't be on set and can't direct, I mean, first of all, there's union rules that say the movie can't go on without the director on set. You can't shoot scenes without the director there, or at least giving permission to a second unit director kind of situation. But like, that means it's just incredibly expensive then to pay for all of that labor to sit around for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks while someone goes through all this.
Especially if you can't get insurance coverage for it.
So, I mean, it is a somewhat unique business in the sense that, like, even, you know, look, this is an issue to some extent in like the bar business, in that if the whole staff gets sick, your bar can't open. At the same time, if one bartender has COVID and can't work for a week or two, probably you can still keep operating. But the movie business is very different in that it is highly dependent on specific people not like having physical access to their bodies and being able to be around other people in a way that is not like, you know, office jobs that frankly that all three of us have.
Yeah. The second thing here is the pace of tentpoles. And I agree with Alyssa that it is better. I think it is better for the industry writ large not to have a $300 million movie debuting every week which is what we had been veering towards for the last couple of years here, you know, where we were getting basically a movie that cost between $100 and $200 million dropping 3 out of 4 weekends a month. That was unsustainable, and the faster we move away from that, the better. That said, I mean, for these movies, these smaller movies, to get the audience, you need to be advertising them, and that is expensive. That's a big cost for the studios, and most of them are not super interested, apparently, in making it, because I'm looking at this lineup of films. I've seen trailers for some of them. I've seen trailers for some of them multiple times, but I don't know, like, ad campaigns? I don't know where the awareness for them is going to be coming from.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think the ad campaigns for some of them may not be targeted at you. Like, Don't Worry, Darling is all over my Instagram feed, for example, like, populating all of the time. Like, and that's a smart ad feed, right? Like, I'm very much the audience for something like that. So, you know, it just may be that a different audience is getting catered to. And, I wanted to add one thing. I mean, I think that this is, you know, traumatic. I think it's probably going to be traumatic for theaters in the short term. It may be quite a difficult pivot. At the same time, if we're entering an era where Hollywood is not going to get access to China and Russia, this pandemic or no pandemic, this kind of transition may have been inevitable because there are only so many $300 million movies that you can support without access to some of those overseas markets. And so, you know, with China backing away from American movies a lot, with, you know, diplomatic tensions with Russia, you know, I think that the idea of the sort of globally supported hit may be under a certain amount of threat. And so I don't think you were going to be able to support 40, $300 million movies in the new geopolitical environment.
Yeah, that's probably true. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that theaters are being abandoned by the studios? More importantly, that across the movie aisle is going to have to be like across the streaming aisle, I guess, for the next several months. Peter?
I think it's a huge controversy that no one is super excited about the re-release of Avatar on September 23rd.
I think that got pushed back. I think that actually got pushed back to after when the new Avatar is coming out.
It's still on Box Office Mojo right now.
I know it's still on Box Office Mojo, but I'm pretty sure that got pushed back. Alyssa?
I'm just going to make us do like 3 episodes on The Woman King, and that's how we'll solve our problem. It's a controversy.
That movie looks questionable. I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure about that one. I don't know. It's a controversy, I guess. My big concern here is that I think movie theaters are like going to take a fairly sizable hit, and the contractions that we have seen in the number of screens may well ramp up during this period of time when there isn't a ton of stuff for them, and that's bad. That's bad for the industry as a whole. All right, on to the main event, The Gray Man, which we're watching because, hey, there's really nothing in theaters this week. The Gray Man stars Ryan Gosling as secret agent Sierra Six, who is rescued from prison by Billy Bob Thornton and turned into a marvelous killer for the deep state. He is on assignment, and he learns that CIA is trafficking in, I don't know, bad stuff. CIA is doing bad things. He gets some intel about the bad things that the head of the CIA is doing. So the head of the CIA, or like some sort of underling in the CIA, none of this is really very clear to me, decides to eliminate him by sending Lloyd Hansen, who was played by Chris Evans's mustache, after him. To survive, Six must team up with Danny Miranda, who is played by Ana de Armas, in a series of boxy sackcloth outfits. And they have to rescue the daughter of Billy Bob Thornton. Claire is played by Julia Butters. And the plot of this $200 million movie is like almost aggressively generic. Like it's like the definition of genre is this movie. Like here's a generic idea for a movie. I'm not going to waste any more time on that. The real question is whether or not Netflix got $200 million worth of bang for their buck on the screen. I'll say it came close-ish. Yeah, there's one really, really awful sequence where Ryan Gosling is like falling out of a plane. I can't believe I'm saying this, but Uncharted did this better earlier in the year somehow. But there's also a pretty big shootout on the streets of Prague that feels epic and big, right? In a way that few other Netflix originals do. Shootout in the castle at the end is fine. Shootout in the restaurant early on is fine. Most of it's just fine. Couple good sequences, whatever. The most interesting thing about this picture, to me anyway, is the way the Russo brothers, Joe and Anthony Russo, who previously of the Infinity War films and blah, 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 they use drone cameras in very interesting ways to both cover like great stretches of territory and get intimate with actors during the action scenes. Combined with Michael Bay's drone work in Ambulance, it feels like we're actually getting close to a new idea of the establishing shot, one that doesn't rely on janky CGI to zoom us quickly through big parcels of land, or helicopters, which obviously can't get too close to the action. That's kind of neat. Yeah, I guess. That said, maybe I'm just grasping at straws here as I try to find something nice to say about this movie other than, hey, at least it's better than Red Notice. Alyssa, what did you make of The Gray Man?
So as an obnoxious Yale graduate, I appreciate that this is a movie about how people who go to Harvard are terrible.
The worst.
In all seriousness, I think this is aggressively mediocre, but I do really enjoy that it is part of Chris Evans' oeuvre of asshole Chris performances. You know, we got a version of this in Knives Out, obviously. Another riff on this in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I enjoy Chris Evans in just like aggressive jerk mode.
This is also his Human Torch, of course, in the first Fantastic Four movies.
Exactly. So I think that is like, you know, it's like moderately enjoyable on that level. I also, it's sort of interesting to me that the movie has this sort of undercurrent of the bad guys being sexist, right? Like Renee John Page's character, like sort of aggressively getting in, you know, other, you know, female character space and, you know, sort of denigrating them and their ability to do their work. There's a lot of sort of condescension towards the female characters. But all of this would land more effectively and interestingly if the female characters like were people at all other than sort of appendages. So it's, I mean, you know, if it's supposed to be an action movie with ideas, which I don't even really think it is, they're very underbaked. And, you know, they're just, other than, you know, Chris Evans' character, there's just not a lot. There's nothing that feels like particularly distinctive about this, right? Like his, like, you know, gleeful Ivy League torturer is the closest thing the movie has to sort of specificity or character work. Since the two of you have not watched Bridgerton, this movie will not be interesting to you in the sense that it's like sort of the next time people are getting a big look at Renee Jean Page, who was like one of the real breakouts of the first season of Bridgerton.
Can I ask, his name is spelled with a G, R-E-G-E? Is that, am I just like misunderstanding how this is like?
No, I am mispronouncing his name, which is totally embarrassing. Regé Jean Page.
No, I was looking at it, I was like, is it Reggae Jean? I think it's Regé.
Anyway, I mean, I think it's sort of a bummer that this is such a boring role for him. And it also just feels like a typical, oh, you know, I made my bones in something for the ladies that involved me being like very, very naked and having a lot of sex. And now, of course, I have to do like a buttoned up action villain dude role. And so, you know, if this is meant to be part of his sort of audition to be the next 007, which I don't think he has a realistic chance of being under any circumstances, it's sort of a bummer. Not much here for the ladies, guys. Not much here for the ladies.
There's not much here for the guys either. Like, yeah. I said, the most offensive thing about this movie is the outfits that they saddle Ana de Armas with, who, of course, most people will recognize from the James Bond film, where she is the best sequence in No Time to Die, where she is his liaison in Cuba.
Also Knives Out.
And well, she's in Knives, but whatever. Not what I'm interested in here. I'm more interested in the Cuba sequence of No Time to Die. I mean, she's wearing like these giant shoulder pad suits, and then like at the end of the movie, she's like dressed all in black. I don't care for it. I don't care for it. Wasting her.
I mean, she's apparently going to be pretty naked as Marilyn Monroe in Blonde later this year. So you have that to look forward to.
We'll discuss that. Don't worry.
But no, this is very generic, except for the fact that it makes the point that people who went to Harvard are bad.
Peter, what did you make of this?
She's also the computer-generated AI lover gal in Blade Runner 2049.
Blade Runner 2049.
Which is great, which she was, you know, also paired with Ryan Gosling in. I can barely discuss this movie because it's so deeply unmemorable, right? I watched this 5 days ago or something like that, 4 days ago, and I could barely tell you the sequence of events that like drives the plot that moves from one bit to another. The movie just sort of like glides over you and like doesn't stick at all. And I just found this movie, it's like, it's something, it's bad, but it's like a special kind of bad that isn't like, wow, this is awful. It's just not really, It makes almost no effort to engage or capture your attention, even though many of the constituent components are actually pretty competently produced. And so obviously, like, this cast is really strong. I found Regé Jean Page, whatever we're going to call him. I found him to be like the weakest link in the acting here. But, like Alfred Woodard and Billy Bob Thornton are great in this, even in their little roles. Maybe not great, but like they're in this and they're great actors. And like they command the screen, even though they have absolutely nothing to do. Right. Like the movie just doesn't care that it has these great actors, but the great actors are great because like even in very unmemorable material, they kind of manage to sort of make scenes work and get things going. But this is like emblematic of this movie's failures is it has a bunch of talent and no interesting ideas and no interest in really engaging viewers with something other than, sort of here are you, Sonny, you described this as like, this is the definition of genre. It's like, let's take the most generic ideas possible. Everything that you expect from a movie like this and just make sure it's there. And it just doesn't work. It doesn't draw you in at all. It doesn't make, like, again, it's not even that it doesn't make sense. It's that it doesn't in any way make you care. It doesn't make you think about the movie and what's happening at all. And so, like, does anybody know anything about any of these characters besides one of them is a sociopath and some of them went to Harvard? And also the Harvard thing doesn't make any sense because if you look up the ages of the actors, they're all supposed to have gone to Harvard together and they're like 12 years older and younger than each other. And it's just nonsense all throughout. It's total nonsense. And I like the only thing in this movie that made me actually was like, oh yeah, that's great. Was freaking Chris Evans' mustache.
The mustache.
That's it. It was the mustache. Sells the whole movie. The whole thing. Like even Ryan Gosling, who I really like and who again is holds the screen very well. Just like you can, he doesn't have to do anything. He sort of has to stand there and like be filmed. And you just like the camera likes him and your eyes like him, right? Like he's good. And yet, like, what's he there for? He doesn't know. This movie doesn't know. It provides no reason for you to care about anything that's happening. I think one place where I will say this movie is incompetent is actually in the editing. So there's a bunch of interesting shots in this movie, and not one of them is completed or held long enough for you to care about it. It's not that the editing is incoherent. It's not that you can't follow the action when people are fighting. That's not what I'm saying at all. It's actually reasonably clear what's going on and who's punching who and what corners they're coming out from, you know, hiding behind. But you keep seeing shots that you want to sort of hold on, that you want to, that you want to use to say something about the action and follow through, right? And great action will sort of sometimes it'll move into a really fast series of edits, but often like my favorite action scenes always have like some, if they're not quite like long takes like Scorsese Goodfellas long takes, but they will have takes that they hold on for long enough that you see a continuous action and that somebody is moving through. This movie never ever does that. At every single point, it's like, well, here's an idea for a shot. Here's another idea. And like by the time we get through, like we cycle through all of these shots, I'm just like, what are you trying to say with this? What are you trying to do? Even those interesting drone shots, and I agree they're kind of interesting, movies just sort of seemingly randomly cutting from one to the next in a way that actively repels interest and tells you, hey, we don't really know what this is about or why we're doing this. So we're just going to move on to the next thing.
Well, I do have a theory on this here, and it's a similar sort of thing that we saw in Ambulance, which is that I don't think filmmakers quite understand how to integrate this footage into the rest of the film. I don't think they quite understand how to, and I don't know if it's just a function of like, well, this is a new thing, and they're working with different ways to try and figure it out, or if they're having to cut around bumps or jostles in the actual drone footage that would make it look weird.
I thought it worked a lot better in Ambulance, and in part because Michael Bay's whole style is to throw you off and make you feel just kind of constantly jostled, and it makes sense in the context of a Michael Bay movie.
This is the irony is that I think it's actually done worse in Michael Bay, but it works better for that film. I think it's done worse in Ambulance, but it works better in that film because Michael Bay's style is like he is the chaos cinema guy. He is like the guy who just throws things at you and like whatever. And it works less well here because I do think the Russo brothers, like, the Russos are taking a ton of shit for this movie, and I don't think it's entirely deserved. But, like, the one thing that they have always done very well is the fluidity of action in the Captain America movies and in the Infinity War and Endgame, right? Like, they understand how to kind of seamlessly move the action and how action should look on screen. And so when the drone shots aren't integrated perfectly, and again, I don't think they quite are, which is why I say we're approaching a new language of cinema. I don't think we've quite gotten there yet. It's actually like kind of jarring compared to some of the rest of the stuff in it. But it's at least interesting. It's at least interesting.
But I think the editing is a mess, even in the sequences that don't have drone shots, even in where it's the drone shots aren't part of it. This movie can't hold on a single visual idea. And so one of the most interesting interviews I've read in the last couple of years with a filmmaker was with Christopher Nolan, who just talked about Christopher Nolan's a big Stanley Kubrick fan. He oversaw the analog redo of 2001 that was came into theaters a couple of years ago. And Christopher Nolan talked about Stanley Kubrick and the idea of a single visual image capturing the entire idea of something. And you see this all over Stanley Kubrick's work. Kubrick did not cut a lot. He would just give you a great single image that told you what you needed to know. It gave you both the action, right, the specific, like the narrative specifics, but also the thematics. And you can see that's in his cuts too, to some extent. But it's in just in those images, right? The most obvious one is the bone being thrown up into the air, and then you see the spaceship, right? You know, in 2001, and so you see in a single set of two images in one cut, the entire evolution of man's relationship to tools. This movie just cuts because it's like, we're bored. That's it. It's like, there's never a reason for a cut. There's never a reason for this shot or that shot. And it's constantly telling you that it doesn't care. And therefore you shouldn't care.
I have a hard time pinning that on this movie specifically. That is just endemic to action movies in general at this point.
It's also, like many action movies at this point, so dark that it is just,
yes,
you know, it cannot hold your, you know, your attention at all. I mean, I watched this movie over a couple of sessions because it's been a crazed couple of days. And when I watched it, you know, as God intended, on my phone with the brightness turned up while sitting on the bus, it was actually easier to watch than it was without the brightness adjusted on my laptop. Like, I could see what was going on more clearly.
Because you got to watch it on an OLED in a basement with no windows.
I watched it in theaters. I actually was one of the like 17 people who saw this movie in a theater. I went to a theater to watch it with a paying audience, and it was impossibly muddy. Yeah. on the screen I watched it on in a theater. Just like not easily seen at all.
I'm sorry. Like, why does everything in action movies have to take place at night? Right? I mean, like, things could just take place during the day. They could. There's nothing wrong with it.
The best sequence in this movie does. I mean, that Czech Republic scene is actually, I think that's actually a very well done action sequence. I thought that was pretty good.
I think it's pretty good. It's like a 7 out of 10.
It's acceptable.
It's as good as anything that's been in a Netflix movie.
It's absolutely the best part of the movie.
But also, if you're going to do like the whole like Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire ripoff for your like maze ripoff action sequence for your finale, like, you can do that during the day. You don't have to do it as the sun is coming up.
I'm sure there was a very important plot reason it had to be done at night. I can't remember because I can't remember the plot. But
you can try Wizard Tournament that stuff in the full light of day. You just can.
So, in fact, just from a filmmaking perspective, daytime in the actual outside circumstances, it's harder to film because you got to deal with clouds and light matching. And so this is one of the reasons why things are either shot in, you know, in warehouses with light using, you know, fake light, or at night, because it's genuinely difficult to control, to deal with shooting during daytime because sometimes there are clouds or sometimes there's weather. And it's just like there's great stories about Steven Spielberg on the set of Temple of Doom. And like they're shooting the end sequence out of the valley that he comes out of, that Indiana Jones comes out of, the ride sequence, right? The where he's on like the roller coaster situation and like with the bridge and everything. And Spielberg's just like, yeah, we would just sit around for hours and hours waiting for the clouds to move. And then like, we'd have like 15 minutes. We'd try to shoot something and it wouldn't work. And they'd be like, oh, clouds again. Clouds are a big problem. They're very expensive.
I would deal with some cloud matching in a scene that I could actually see versus not being able to see what's going on.
You're so demanding, Alyssa.
You know, I have standards. I'm not going to apologize for them.
Well, you are a Yale grad, so that makes that makes sense. Yes, all right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Gray Man? Peter?
Weird mix of highly competent and quite bad.
That's not a thumbs up or thumbs down.
That's a thumbs down.
Okay. Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
I give it a thumbs up, actually, because I
wow.
is as weak as it is generally, it is still competent, and like it is a perfect. Again, if I had watched this at home, while on my OLED with its perfect black levels and folding socks as God intended, instead of in a theater like an idiot, I probably would have enjoyed this a lot.
You should have brought your socks to the theater.
So, you know, say what you will, but it has the sock folding test met. All right, that's it for this week's show. No bonus episode this Friday. Scheduling has conspired to defeat us. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SundayBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.